Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot can happen in a year. Trends, debuts, world-altering events, and pop culture and film is there to reflect it all back to us generations down the line. Welcome to the A Year in Film podcast, presented by Hollywood Suite. I'm your host, Becky Shrimpton, and today I'm joined by Cam Maitland and Alicia Fletcher. It takes a lot of chutzpah to open your own production company in Hollywood. In the late 60s and early 70s, with a new wave of movies being produced and distributed independently, it seemed like it just might work out for Dennis Friedland and Chris Dewey. They'd found some success producing English versions of softcore Swedish films and even produced a movie that got nominated for an Oscar for adapted writing and gave Susan Sarandon her doe-eyed film debut. That movie was Joe. But by 1979, a string of failed features meant that the duo had to bail out. And fast. So they sold their company, Canon Films, to two Israeli cousins, Menachem Golan and Yoram Globus. The two had already produced, and in one case directed, some bonkers movies in Israel. Like the bright and exuberant film The Apple, which, Alicia, seems like something you would be into.
Once again, have not seen it. Seems what? Like I would be into it.
Oh, you yeah. would be into it. It's Xanadu, basically.
Yeah, I will get on that.
And the wildly popular Lemon Popsicle, which, Cam, seems like something you would have seen.
You know what? I haven't seen Lemon Popsicle, but I've seen The Last American Virgin, which is a pretty much direct translation of Lemon Popsicle. I mean, why that movie stands out so much is that it's, like, without considering American culture at all, a direct translation of an Israeli yeah. film. So you're like, wow, I didn't know that American teens went to, sex workers so frequently. But.
Yeah, sure. Well, Golan and Globus wanted to try their hand at the American market, and so they bought Canon Films. I'm sure we'll touch back on Canon several times throughout the entirety of this podcast, but for now, we'll focus on 1986, which was a huge year for Canon in terms of their growth as a company, as well as a controversial figure. Globus and Golan in 86 were riding high. They'd had a number of successes with the box office, including with films like Breakin' and their successful run of sequels based on already proven properties, like the Death Wish franchise. They'd also been nominated for an Oscar in 85 with their movie Runaway Train. Their theory was that Hollywood was all talk and not enough action, so if they made movies at a rapid enough pace and just kept releasing them, they were sure to run circles around the rest of the industry. See, in their hearts, even though Menachem Golan was a director, he and Globus were salesmen, not artists. So in 1985, they showed up at the Cannes Film Festival with this massive pamphlet of one-page ads for movies, 90% of which hadn't even entered into pre-production. They then showed it to distributors and said, which ones would you want to buy? And those are the movies that got made. And what's wild is that there's some movies in there that got made that say they star one actor, but the actual movie has someone else in the lead. Like 52 Pickup says it stars Stallone, but it ends up starring Roy Scheider.
They're almost the same, right?
It's on Hollywood Suite right now if you want to watch it.
Yeah. Well, it's also important to note that while Canon was pushing to produce more high-end materials made with auteur-era directors like Jean-Luc Godard's version of King Lear and Zeffirelli's extravagant all-opera version of Othello featuring world-renowned tenor Placido Domingo in blackface in the title role. But despite all of the aims at prestige, the 32 movies that Canon released in 86 are mostly their usual exploitative schlock. And that's where they got into the most controversy, with the movie The Delta Force. I was talking to my partner about this, and he was like, Delta Force! That was one of my favorites when I was a kid. Chuck Norris and Lee Marvin come in, and there's like a plane full of hostages, and they take out the bad guys with rocket launchers. It was really cool. He did not, however, realize this was based on an actual hostage situation, and they started making the film in Israel at the same time the hostage situation was still going on, not knowing how it was going to be resolved.
You can't sleep on stuff like that. You gotta go. Go, 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 go. Yeah.
No, because that's how exploitation works. The actual situation involved TWA Flight 847. What happened was that two Arabic-speaking Lebanese men, they were allegedly part of Hezbollah, but Hezbollah denied any affiliation to the event, so it's unclear on if they were part of an organized group. They took a plane full of 147 people hostage in Athens. It was this horrific ordeal that lasted for 2 weeks. They beat the hostages, executed one of them, and threw him out of the plane onto the apron, forced the pilots to fly back and forth between Beirut and Algiers. They separated all the passengers with Jewish-sounding last names, like really, really horrible
stuff.
Oh, I
saw a movie about this. There was a movie at Berlin a few years ago starring Rosamund Pike about this hostage situation. I don't even think it got released, but...
The film was released. It's called 7 Days in Entebbe.
I definitely sat through that. It felt like 7 days.
24% on Rotten Tomatoes. You are not alone, Alicia.
Right.
Well, that movie at least sounds slightly more accurate than what happened in the Delta Force, because the real hostage event ended with Israel releasing over 700 Shia prisoners, but they maintained that had nothing to do with the hostage situation. One of the hijackers was arrested later, but the other one went free. In the Delta Force, it's not just two guys. It's like a whole squad of just repulsively stereotypical Arabic-speaking terrorists. They're eventually defeated in this incredibly violent way by Chuck Norris and his gang. At one point, Chuck Norris uses a rocket launcher from a motorbike. That's apparently a crowning moment. Victor Canby said, "The Delta Force will be the 1986 film all others will have to beat for sheer, unashamed, hilariously vulgar vaingloriousness."
Sure.
Did I mention that the movie was directed by Menachem Golan himself? Well, if you want to know more about Canon Films, there are three documentaries out there. Electric Boogaloo, The Wild Untold Story of Canon Films, made in 2014. And that one kind of feels like fanboys trying to be unbiased. There's The Go-Go Boys, which was rushed into production and released before Electric Boogaloo because Globus and Golan caught wind of the documentary and wanted their own version. But my personal favorite is a 1986 doc made by the BBC called The Last Moguls, which features actual footage of Menachem on the phone in business deals, including ones where he's trying to recruit famous directors to make pictures for him, like Peter Bogdanovich, where Menachem said, "He's a loser working with losers and he needs to get with the winners."
Oh, wow.
Bogdanovich didn't end up working for Canon, but another high-profile director did. Toby Hooper was fresh off Poltergeist when he was signed to a 3-picture deal. He promised he would make Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, and we're going to talk about that in a later episode, but he had free rein on the other 2 pictures. The movies he chose to make clearly reflect his love of the classic B-movie, and I can imagine him as a young person racing home to catch one of those movies presented by local TV hosts with, like, creepy character names like Morgus the Magnificent, Mona Lisa, or Sir Graves Ghastly.
Can I give a shout-out to another one?
Of course.
Goulardi, a.k.a. Ernie Anderson, the father of Paul Thomas Anderson. I just learned recently from a friend of the show that Paul Thomas Anderson's dad was one of these, like, midnight movie hosts on local television. Mm-hmm. He was, like, a real legend named Goulardi.
A very weird Goulardi fact. Drew Carey always wore a shirt of him.
How do you know this?
That's how I knew who
he
was.
The other one I know about from the 50s is Zachary. Zachary was apparently like a really big deal.
Yeah.
He was syndicated. Yeah. So just wild. And I mean, I get it because there would be something magic about that, especially when you're a young person, like rushing home or like turning it on late at night past your bedtime and being like, what sort of weird stuff I'm going to see? And the 80s are full of these B-movie remakes and tributes, and they're made lovingly and artfully by masters. Think about Carpenter's The Thing or Cronenberg's The Fly and Chuck Russell's The Blob. Mm-hmm. Classic horror director of Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Poltergeist had all the potential in the world to make his own tribute to the genre. Working from a script based on a classic 50s B-movie, Invaders from Mars seems to be an attempt to create a child's horror version of one of those movies, but it ends up being almost Ken Russellian in nature at some points.
Interesting, yeah.
Yeah, Dan O'Bannon, who wrote Alien, is one of the co-writers behind the script, so that makes sense that there would be some vagina stuff. So let's get into Invaders from Mars and Toby Hooper's second movie from his 3-picture deal with Canon. Because the first one is Life Force. Leonard Maltin describes it as berserk. I made it about halfway through, and it is, in fact, berserk. It is nuts.
It rules, Becky. I don't know what you're talking about. was an all-nude vampire lady not good enough for
you? It just flips through so many different genres that it's like, sure. What is happening?
And
should
be said, also written by Dan O'Bannon.
Yes, that's right. So, I mean, one of the things that I love so much, and this is Tobey Hooper very much collaborating with the same people for his three-picture deal, because that was Life Force, Invaders from Mars, and the third is Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, which he promised he would do them.
Yes, that's how he got the deal, right? He promised he'd make a Texas Chainsaw Massacre sequel. And then it's also worth saying that this film stars the ex-wife and child of the writer of Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2.
And Kit Carson is in this as well. Yeah, so that's
it's a strange bedfellows made Invaders from Mars.
I couldn't see Kit Carson in the film, but I was trying to look for him and I couldn't. I'm sure maybe he's in the background. Is he actually an actor in it?
So he's in the background in Invaders from Mars. He's not in Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yeah, he wrote Texas Chainsaw Massacre, just as in Invaders from Mars.
But yes, his ex-wife, we should also say, is Karen Black, who we love so much and talked about as starring in Day of the Locust.
I can say my love for Karen Black perhaps does not extend to Hunter Carson or child.
No. But before we get into that, let's talk a little bit about the plot of Invaders from Mars. Cam, do you want to do this one?
Sure. I mean, it's right there on the tin. a child wakes up in the middle of the night, thinks he sees a UFO land. He's also kind of a scaredy cat child. I think he has nightmares and stuff before the UFO lands. A bit of a dreamer. His parents, Timothy Bottom and Lorraine Newman of SNL, they're like, oh, don't worry about it. And his dad's kind of like, oh, yeah, don't worry, kid. I'll go check it out. And then in the morning, his father seems strange. It kind of, from there, continues the post Invasion of the Body Snatchers, I think also mini trend of essentially body snatch movies like Strange Invaders, like The Thing, like The Martian Chronicles, like even Cocoon, strangely, which is aliens pretending to be human. So slowly, the kid is noticing more and more people are weird. Again, like we say, it's a bit of a, like it's meant to be from a kid's perspective, so the people are very weird, including probably the best turn in the film, Louise Fletcher as his evil teacher.
Yeah.
Eventually, both his parents are quite quickly turned into aliens, and he can only turn to the kindly school nurse, played by Karen Black, who luckily believes him.
Well, occasionally, she's like, please don't just be a crazy child, she actively says to him.
Hold it! I do not understand a single word you're saying.
Come on, I'll show you.
David! Not just a crazy child, are you?
Yeah. She entertains him, and he manages to give proof that when people are changed, there's something wrong with the back of their necks.
They wear band-aids over their necks.
She notices that the kid is not lying. Yeah. And she also notices, I mean, the joke that's in a lot of critics are like, these people are not acting normally. They are acting like weird zombies. It is not Invasion of the Body Snatchers where they're pretty normal.
I think you know things are really bad when the kid's watching his mom eat. She's like, we're going to have hamburgers for lunch. And then starts eating raw ground meat with a bunch of salt on it.
Not hungry, David? You feel all right?
Yes, Lorraine Newman is having a lot of fun, too, I will say. And or when she makes the weird burnt food and is like, eat up.
Oh, the bacon.
She like cooks all the bacon till it's burnt.
Yeah.
So the people are like weird zombies. But then I think it kind of goes where you wouldn't think, where it is very true to its 50s roots. And then it's actually about Karen Black and the child rousing the military into action against a series of increasingly wacky creatures, including, you know, big kind of meatball monsters and a little goofy alien. And
the little goofy alien looks like Crane from Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
I was thinking the same thing. And these are all Stan Winston creatures and creations. And the amount of work that went into figuring out how they were going to work with like a little person operating the mouth on the back of a stunt performer who's in the bottom half of the outfit. And apparently there was a whole thing where like they were just sweating and they stank and the little people went on strike because they didn't want to be on top of there if they didn't have
to
be. So
I also want to say that it's quite fascinating that the people performing in the suits, the little people especially, are all people you know. They're all famous.
Yeah.
It's Debbie Carrington from Total Recall, Phil Fondacaro from Willow, and Tony Cox from Bad Santa.
Yeah,
so it's
wild.
Like, these are not... I mean, perhaps at the time they did not have the prestige they had, but these would go on to be some of the, like, top performers of the 90s and 2000s, stuck in a backpack made of metal on some random person's back.
You can, you know, for listeners, you can just Google some behind-the-scenes photos of this, these creatures. They're impressive. Mm-hmm. Like, I like this film. It's super silly, whatever. It's not a masterpiece. But what you have to say is, like, Stan Winston's creature effects are remarkable. Yeah. And the way they filmed it, where I think they're walking kind of backwards and then they reversed the film, is really effective. So you get this very uncanniness to the movements. And they only built two of the creatures, and there's like one shot where you see a lot more. And it's like a really interesting, innovative effect where they kind of did a graphic matching or something like that.
I think what you were getting at, there's this kind of concept through the 80s of the monster kid. It's often ascribed to Joe Dante. And I think that it's funny because this movie kind of, so the 50s movies were like, you know, Forrest J. Ackerman's like famous Monsters of Filmland magazine. Like kids, these movies were terrible in the 50s, but kids would see this monster and be like, oh man. And so many of them went on to be inspired. It's funny because the Monster Kid directors, you don't say like Carpenter and Cronenberg are Monster Kids, even though they are Monster Kids.
Yeah.
But I think that this film ends up kind of being like the 50s movie, is because I really don't think that there's much worth to the movie around it, but I do think that the monsters are also cool.
I think the tonality doesn't necessarily work in the point of view. It took me about halfway through to figure out, oh, this is a kid's movie, and it's actually like a dream from his point of view, which is why people are acting the way they're acting and why he's saving the day as much as he is.
And why there's low camera angles. Like, you're actually looking at adults filmed from below, so that, you know, you kind of get that sense of this is from the perspective of someone who might only be 4 feet tall, like an 8-year-old boy.
Totally. And apparently very true to the original. Even that annoying ending is like exactly what the original.
And the original, the kid that appears in the original, the star, is actually like the sheriff or something in this version. There's a nice nod to it. I think coming back to the original, which is 1953, also called Invaders from Mars, and directed by William Cameron Menzies, who was a very prolific director going back to the teens, like silent film. It's not a good film as far as like B films go. It's actually considered one of the worst. And it was rushed into production simply because George Pal and Byron Haskins' War of the Worlds was released in 1953. And I think they filmed, you know, the original of this film like in a few weeks. So it's kind of very in keeping with the original not being very good, that this is got some of that kind of schlockiness, I think.
Yeah, there's a weird, I think to me, the thing that I would like to know, and I get the feeling that Toby Hooper wanted to do a straight movie, but Dan O'Bannon maybe wanted more of the camp, just because I think I ascribe Dan O'Bannon to Return of the Living Dead, which is such a good and campy movie.
So good.
And the fact that, like, to me, the good performances, like Lorraine Newman, Louise Fletcher,
James Caron.
And then,
from Return of the Living Dead.
People being sucked under the sand. A lot of aliens running around loose underneath the town. That's a little hard to swallow.
And also, what's his
Bud
face
Cort.
From Bud Cort? Yeah, Bud Cort is the same.
We don't know that much about them. We don't know why they're here. It's all right, boys. It's all right.
How's he know they're boys?
Shut up.
Like, I think that the people that are good are campy.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, they know what movie they're in.
They're having fun.
But the film is not campy. And almost the kid would work as camp if...
Yeah.
Hunter Carson is, honestly, this needs to anchor around the child actor. And Hunter Carson is not good. And from what it sounds like from multiple interviews I have read, he did not want to be there.
No, yeah.
Yeah, so that sounds challenging.
I mean, that one, the person that's written about it most is one of the effects people, Shannon Shea, has written multiple kind of articles about it. And yeah, the one paints it. But again, Shannon Shea is like, listen, I've been on plenty of sets where kids don't learn their lines. So I was happy with this kid because the takes were quick.
Funny, he's acting opposite his mom. That's kind of unique.
Yes.
And is also meant to have a crush on the character too, which is very
which is
weird.
Yeah. It almost, I mean, I would almost swap in Lorraine Newman.
There's a
just
real,
because she gets it.
There's a real Amblin feel to this. Like, and I know, I think
100%
rumored that this was shopped to Spielberg before Toby Hooper. It just doesn't get pulled off. I guess that's what ends up happening is it's just, I really admire it for making it through the perspective of a child, but I just don't know where we can go with that, to be honest.
There's a lot of ambition, but not the skill. And I think it kind of goes with the same thing as Life Force, because Life Force is intended to be a love story to Hammer horror, specifically Quartermass and The Pit. And so both of these movies are love letters to genres that he loves. And he, you see that he gets some of the tropes, but he doesn't totally understand how to bring that into a modern perspective and make everything work. Because I don't think he can figure out, is it meant to be camp? Do I play this straight? How do I play it? And he never really commits to one. It kind of becomes both at the same time.
I will say who's playing mega camp is Louise Fletcher as the evil teacher. It's really effective, actually.
Look, he's bleeding.
Heather, you supervise while I take this uncontrollable young man to the school nurse. And I hope you need a tetanus shot.
And so if you think of this as a fantasy film that demonstrates how children view adults, how adults, including their parents, their teachers, their authority figures, come off in a child's imagination, then it's effective. And then the kind of one-dimensionality of these characters is perfectly fine. I just don't know how you make that entertaining.
It's having the good kid at the center. It's because Hunter Carson's performance doesn't work. If you had the kid at the center that could, like, really make this make sense and, like, really genuinely be terrified and trying to figure stuff out. Also, I think, Cam, you're mentioning that, like, these people are just straight-up zombies immediately rather than, like, there's just something slightly off about them. I think that would work a little better, too.
An interesting kind of, like, path you can go down is a film that the writer-director says is heavily inspired by the original Invaders from Mars, Another Monster Kid. Don Coscarelli says that Phantasm is Invaders from Mars. And it's the same. When you think about it, it's like, it's a kid. It's all out of control. He can't control it. Everything's very dreamy. And it ends where it's like, is it a dream? Is it not a dream?
And that movie's great.
That movie's great. So that's like, there is a way to sublimate what scared you or inspired you. And it's full of crazy creatures. Not as good looking as these
creatures. I can't believe Stan Winston was filming Aliens at the same time as this.
Well, he apparently brought his kid on, his son, who I believe took over the effects house. This was one of his first jobs, schlepping things.
He was a teenager.
Having to do everything. So, I mean,
we're learning that 1986 was the year of abusing your children by forcing them to poor Brian Henson and Stan Winston.
That's true. I didn't think about that.
And now they both run their empires.
They
Stan Winston's son runs the school. But yeah, I will say, it's worth saying if you enjoy effects stuff, the Stan Winston School does great jobs going through every single movie, both with video clips and with remembrances of like what it was like working on them.
Now, I mentioned this is Ken Russellian, and it struck me immediately when I was looking at the tunnels in the main base where like the Krang creature is and the big creatures. And I was like, oh, this is a vagina, like, or some sort of like, it's very much in the same alien sort of
first
realm.
Canal.
Yeah, 100%. And I was, and then I, it took me a second and I was like, hold on. Is this the Masters of the Universe set? And then I paused it and looked it up and I was like, it is the Masters of the
Universe
set.
I'm very impressed by that. Thank you, Becky. Just to push the vagina metaphor further, if I may, something I've become well known for.
Something you love, yeah.
This company. I would say from the back, the two sort of aliens look like ovaries. And so then you have the crane, like the brain is sort of the uterus and you've got these ovaries and there's and then the two tubes are the fallopian tubes.
I am with you on this metaphor.
We'd have to ring up the production designers. And I mean, everything in design is either phallic or yonic. There's not much other options.
Oh, man. I think the thing that amazes me the most is that, like, Toby Hooper, of course, was signed to the 3-picture deal. And he started out by making Life Force with, like, a good size budget.
Oh, yeah. It's one of the biggest budgets Cannon ever had.
Yeah.
And definitely probably the biggest Toby Hooper ever had.
Definitely. And it didn't make its money back. And then, so they gave him slightly less to make Invaders from Mars. And again, it didn't make its money back. So they gave him even less when he was in pre-production, Texas Chainsaw Massacre. We'll get into, you know, the financial debacles there, which that eventually made its money back, but did not do as well as they thought, which is why they did not sign him on for anything more. But I think there's a freneticness to all three of the films that makes me wonder where Toby Hooper was as, not just as an artist, but like as a human being.
Well, I mean, he's a very interesting guy because he's a real outsider, you know, he kind of never, this is the the highest budget, biggest deal, kind of quote unquote mainstream films he makes. And like
More so than Poltergeist?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Poltergeist, who knows? It's like back and forth on his how much he had control over that film.
Yeah,
I don't know. It's like, I mean, he didn't conceptualize it as well, at the very least. So these were like his front to back. But yeah, it's also weird to me thinking how this film completely does not understand humor and camp, whereas Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 is like one of the best campy horror movies
there is. Oh, God, I love it so much. It's pure burlesque.
But yeah, I think he kind of just went his own way, you know? He's a guy who likes to do what he likes to do. That's what it is. And yeah, and I think he probably never felt like he had to please anybody. There's a good another remembrance of the set. Somebody called him the Yosemite Sam of the DGA. they call him determined, easily aggravated, short memories, reactionary, funny, but very sweet. Yeah. Short memoried. I like it. Sounds like he's getting mad about something he should have remembered.
Reactionary is something that delights me. Just hearing stories about him on all of these sets where he was just like mainlining cigars and Dr. Pepper. And there's Dr. Pepper in like shots of all of his movies because all the crew was just like, there was just one PA just assigned to continually bring him Dr. Pepper. That's just what he did. We're going to be getting into Tobe Hooper way more when we get to Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. That's coming up in a few weeks. But let's move on to our next film. When we come back, we're going to be looking at a movie that I feel was way ahead of its time. Was it? Was it? That's coming up after the break.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Though Invaders from Mars was Tobe Hooper's attempt at recreating a child's experience in the B-movie, Fred Decker's Night of the Creeps is a different comment on the genre. It's savvy, self-aware, and maybe a little too self-aware at times. It feels like something that should have come out in the wake of Wes Craven's Scream or Edgar Wright's Shaun of the Dead. I groaned when I realized the characters had the same last names as famous horror directors. One of them is even hyphenated Carpenter Hooper. Despite its comical tone, and I laughed out loud a few times, it also grossed me out in a few moments. And the only thing I think it didn't get right to reflect the B-movie experience is being boring so I could tune it out and make out with my partner. I liked this one a lot, but I do feel it's ahead of its time, which is why it didn't do as well. Let's talk Night of the Creeps.
Yeah, I really love this film. And I agree with you. I think it's ahead of its time. But just to give a sense of what this film's about, it's about a bunch of creeps.
Yeah,
both in that, you know, the creeps are sluggish alien life forms similar to Shivers and at the same time also frat boys. But the film opens in black and white, which I think is it's a beautiful technique. And it opens in black and white in 1959, where there's an alien experiment. And we do see the aliens. And these are not as good of aliens as the previous film we talked about, Invaders from Mars. Mm-hmm. These aliens look like if a knockoff off-brand E.T. toy had sex with another off-brand knockoff toy from Ridley Scott's Alien and then got sunbleached, it would look like this.
But they have little bums. I love their little bums.
Frowning babies is what Fred Decker said he wanted. And it sure is a frowning baby.
Lots of baby fat, cute little bums anyway. But they implant on Earth these slug-like creatures that take over one's brain.
And one of them goes rogue, don't they? Like,
yeah,
that's
it seems
what
like
happens.
There's like a terrorist that is purposefully stealing the plug.
But you don't know because they go full Skeksis. They don't use any actual language.
No.
And it opens with an axe murderer who's escaped from an asylum who has one of these in his brain. I'm not sure. I can't remember.
Yes. No, he doesn't.
He doesn't.
Actually.
That's the thing.
The boyfriend.
He's just crazy. Yeah, it's the boyfriend.
And he just murders the girl and then gets caught, etc. It's a complicated plot, actually.
And this is witnessed by a police officer who's in love with the girl. The girl's on a date with a jock, and the police officer is going to be the main character, basically, many years later in this film.
Yeah, 30 minutes later in the film.
And so, yeah, they bury the body. They freeze the body of the boyfriend who has the slug in its head.
The government seems to know that this exists.
Sure. Cryogenics are very important in 1986.
Yeah.
Flash forward to Pledge Week, 1986, at a college. And you have two dorks who want to pledge for, like, you know, the jock, like the top fraternity. And the thing the frat boy, and I want to say the head frat boy here is named Brad. His license plate is Bradster, if you want to have a sense of what kind of character this is. He jokes around and is like, well, if you can get us a cadaver, if you can break a body out of the University Science Center, you can come into the fraternity. Unfortunately, the kids go too far. They do this, and it's the frozen body with a slug in its head. It unfreezes, and now the creeps are everywhere. There's a sorority house with lovely Ms. Cronenberg, who's like the woman that this one guy's crushing on. Yeah, it's basically if you put every B movie into a blender.
It's aliens and zombies.
It's aliens. It's
all
zombies.
Together. Serial killer comes back to life as a zombie.
Maniacs escaped from mental hospitals.
It's got Dick Miller in it because if you're
playing. Yeah. Okay, this is the part where we have to get into this. Because Dick Miller is playing the character of Walter Paisley. Now, Walter Paisley, if people don't know, is a character that appears like repeatedly, starting in a bunch of Corman movies and then moving forward. And he always shows up as this character and this whole other world of like who Walter Paisley actually is. If he's a time traveler, like what he is. It's actually kind of fascinating.
We would know from a year in film that Walter Paisley meets his ultimate demise at the hands of the chopping mall robot as a janitor in the titular chopping mall.
It's just such a great thing. Yeah, because everybody loves Dick Miller.
I love this film because to me, the real creeps are the frat boys, regardless of whether they have been infested by alien slugs or not.
If I knew you were gonna pull a downer like this, I never even would have told you.
But that's what I get for going with a fucking psych major, isn't it?
And there's some really, like, I mean, there's some lines that you would imagine are in there, but they're effective when, like, I think at one point the final girl is, like, killing off all these frat boys, and she's like, don't you understand? No means no. Like, there's a lot of sort of date rape sort of metaphors in this, and really the creeps are these, like, just total losers like Bradster. When Bradster gets zombified, his girlfriend doesn't realize it, and like she leads him to the deck and breaks
one
up
of the
with
best
him. It's
parts, yeah,
so good.
There's a long regular scene where he's a zombie.
Yeah, and this stars Tom Atkins, who I am a huge fan of, as the police officer in the 1950s who witnesses his ex-girlfriend being murdered. He's now a detective and, you know, knows exactly what's happening because he's witnessed this in the past.
And he has a catchphrase that is used specifically throughout the whole thing. In fact, the making of documentary is called Thrill Me, because that's what he says when he answers the phone or he walks into a crime scene, or he's like, thrill me. And I love this. This movie was so cult hit that he got approached by a woman in a grocery store who saw him, freaked out, and yelled, thrill me! And then handed him a bunch of promotional pencils from her business where she had been using thrill me to promote her business on these pencils. It's amazing.
I was just going to say, I love that Fred Decker says that the origin of the script, like, cause he's like, obviously the script is 100 different ideas I just mooshed together, but he's like, the first idea he had was a guy picking up the phone and saying, thrill me.
Thrill me.
Yeah, that does not usually a screenplay make, but somehow, I have to say, I think Thrill Me is a good line, but I love when he's shooting the zombies and he goes, it's Miller time.
True. I mean, my favorite part of that character is the incredibly good sequence where it's kind of quickly revealed, the kid comes to his door. Mm-hmm. He's kind of just sitting there weirdly, and the kid comes to his door, and you see him remove all this tape from his door, and you're like, what? And then it's kind of slowly showing that he was going to kill
himself.
Yeah,
the oven door's open.
And then he decides, it's so good that, yeah, it's just such a good character moment that is like, you know, it's show, don't tell, where this guy had completed what he thought was his thing, and he was going to just kill himself until then he has to take part in Act 3, which is awesome.
Yeah, if Hunter Carson is terrible in Invaders from Mars and might arguably destroy the likability of that film, this film could have gone that way, I think, and is absolutely anchored by wonderful performances of Tom Atkins, mm-hmm. as well as the two leads who played the friends, the two male friends.
Yeah. Jason Lively and Steve Marshall. And I love...
And Cynthia.
She's
too,
great.
I
yeah.
think.
It's great chemistry across the board. And that's Jill Whitlow. Steve Marshall, mm-hmm. who plays JC, who's on crutches, which is an interesting aspect of the character.
Yeah.
He is so charming and so funny. And for a character that could easily have been your write-off best friend, you are actually upset when he dies because he leaves this little sad message being like, one of them got in my mouth. I'm a goner. Sorry, bud. And it's just like, but I liked you. I liked you so much.
There's a lot of readings of his character being queer, and I'm undecided on that. I don't think Fred Dekker wrote this
with a
queer character in mind.
Yeah, I think... yeah, it's fun. It's interesting because it's like, yeah, is this movie super progressive or just accidental?
Or people reclaiming this like the Babadook?
Yeah, it's like Babashook, right? Like it really is an afterthought of a reading, but it works. Can we come back to Tom Atkins? I have a bit of a story.
Of course we can. Mm. Yes, go for it.
It's in my canon of embarrassing stories. I started an internship when I was doing my master's in film preservation at then called the George Eastman House. It's the palace of film. First day of my internship, they were giving a tour to some people who were presenting a film that night at the movie theater, the Dryden. They asked me what I was doing. My task was I was writing numbers on thousands of Warner Brothers film stills from the 1930s. And one man took a really keen interest in these stills. Like, he sat down beside me, was looking at them. Flash forward to lunch. It's your first day of your internship, and I'm really nervous, and it's a tiny cafeteria. These people who were on the tour were at a table, and I was eating by myself, and this nice older man invited me to, you know, come and eat. And I was like, why not? This was the guy who was really into the film stills. I did not know I was having lunch with Tom Atkins and Fred Dekker. I had never seen any of their films. This is about 12, 13 years ago. I no idea. And I didn't know I didn't understand that one was a director and one was an actor. I didn't know that the film I had bought a ticket for, which was this film, was going to have them in it for that night. I asked Tom Atkins what he did for a living. I remember Fred Dekker's reaction was being, I didn't care about Fred Dekker. And he was so nice. When I say he was so nice, he was the loveliest person. He was like, oh, I'm an actor. I didn't ask him, what have you been in? He wanted to just ask me about film preservation. He was so fascinated by what he had seen in the film vaults, about those Warner Brothers stills. He had a really good knowledge of 1930s film, so he knew some of the stills I was working on. And we just spent the 45-minute lunch talking about film history in the 30s and did not... It's probably the only time Fred Dekker and Tom Atkins have done a horror event and not been asked any questions about horror films. And I only found out later who they were. I remember calling my boyfriend at the time and being like, yeah, the guys that are presenting this film tonight called Monster Squad, I've never seen it. And he was like horrified that I had asked Tom Atkins.
Yeah.
They were doing The Fog, Monster Squad, and Night of the Creeps. He was horrified when I was like, I asked him what he did for a living. And now I love Drive Angry. I love all the Tom Atkins films. And I have such a fond memory of him.
I mean, he's an interesting guy because he got famous when he was a bit older than you normally would as a celebrity. And he got famous for being a cop on the Rockford Files.
Oh, wow.
He's what I think we will in the fullness of time understand Elijah Wood to be, where it's like he's a guy who just he liked genre movies, and the minute they were like you can star in whatever, he's like horror please. And then he just continued to do it, you know. He's in other stuff, but the best stuff
I'm almost glad I can't redo that movies. Lunch because it's better to have not asked him anything about Night of the Creeps, because now I have so many questions. And he says that this is his favorite film and his favorite role. which I think makes sense to me.
Totally. Well, let's talk about Fred Dekker for a second, because this is obviously him being a fanboy. This is the first film he wrote and directed. He has a couple short films before this. He wrote the story for the film House, which is a movie I really like. I think it's just wild. Where people will remember it's like the disembodied zombie hand touching the doorbell for the poster.
Yeah. And ironically, they blame that their poster was too much like the House poster for Night of the Creeps. And that's why part of what ruined their marketing.
Okay, I get it. It's and there's three different versions of this poster as well. He clearly loves the genre. He, of course, the next thing he would do is The Monster Squad, which is the take on
The movie about
exactly
monsters.
And is it riff on Universal Monsters? So you have like another deep love. I do not think Monster Squad holds up as well as this one does. There's a bunch of stuff in Monster Squad. I'm like, no, but I understand people have very strong nostalgic attachments.
Tom Noonan as Frankenstein is pretty wonderful.
Wonderful. I will give you that. Yeah, there's just too many homophobic slurs for my particular taste. So yeah, not my thing. But I think then you see kind of what he went on for his career as a writer, and you're looking at stuff like RoboCop 3, which he completely disowns.
Well, RoboCop 3, I was going to say, is famous for ruining everyone's careers. It was, I believe it was meant to be theatrical, and it was so ruinous it went straight to video. But it's also why Frank Miller didn't adapt any of his comics to films for almost 20 years. It took Robert Rodriguez essentially like convincing him with Sin City to ever adapt any of his comics. Not that my heart only slightly goes to Frank Miller because he's a maniac jerk. But it's kind of fascinating because his experience with Fred Dekker, and Fred Dekker even blames himself for ruining Frank Miller's experience, but it was so bad on RoboCop 3, he essentially quit Hollywood for a long time.
Wow. Well, he's also done a bunch of Tales from the Crypt, which I love. That show just so holds up. That's one of my in-the-background shows. So, I mean, clearly you've got another case of a fanboy who understands the tropes and then understands how to make it modern, which is why I put it in the same kind of context as, like, Edgar Wright. Like, this is very Shaun of the Dead to me.
Yeah,
and he's super close with Shane Black, too. Like, they kind of go back and forth working together. So
More than that, he lived in a house when they went to UCLA together with Shane Black and Chris Matheson and Ed Solomon, who do Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure and all the Bill and Ted.
The cinephile fraternity.
That's right. Their house was called The Pad of Guys.
Wow, not great writing for that house name.
And I love how he just throws stuff. He's like, so I was at The Pad of Guys. It's a little strange.
Weird.
Yeah, but, you know, young,
but yeah,
drunk.
I think you can see it's very fascinating the way he like puts together the pastiche. And I do want to briefly shout out, weirdly, there's a Canadian film that just because I love that opening that does like 10 different things. There's a Canadian film the same year called Killer Party that also does where it starts off in a movie and then the movie is on a screen at a drive-in and then the drive-in is a music video that then a frat is watching. And I'm like, oh, hey, it's great that two movies did that. But I also want to just say that like the pastiche, like, I can get the pastiche a bit in Night of the Creeps and all the different things, but, like, for instance, I just realized watching it this time, there's, like, a leitmotif of, with especially Tom Atkins' character, of the Platters' Smoke Gets in Your Eyes playing whenever kind of bad stuff happens, because that's his girlfriend. And as much as that's a big hit from the 50s, it is also the main kind of romantic leitmotif in American Graffiti. So on top of being a pastiche of 50s stuff, it's also like a pastiche of the 70s remembrance of 50s stuff.
Watching that 50s sequence, that we talked about before, I was reminded of Twin Peaks The Return and that very famous episode, I believe it's the 8th episode, where we go back to the 50s and it's black and white and music very similar to that. I don't believe it is the Platters. Maybe it is. Is it?
It might be. Honestly, there is a great article I suggest people look up on RogerEbert.com called The Smoke Gets in Your Eyes Cinematic Universe and the various kind of like, because it's been used significantly in multiple films since the 1930s. Yeah. It's a song from the 30s, I guess. So there's Fred Astaire singing
it. This is one of the movies that I'm so glad it came out on DVD at a time when they were still doing director's commentaries and like making little like making of DVD featurettes for things. Because this one especially, getting to see all the special effects, because there's a lot of really cool effects in here. I mean, the little wormy guys are really gross, and because they're practical, are awesome.
The head splitting open is very good.
The axe murderer comes back to life 35 years later. It's
great puppet zombie.
Totally fantastic. And I love that the house of the frat guys is called the Betas, which is brilliant. And all of the guys in the frats are the FX guys in order to save money so that they could cast their own heads
mold
exactly
their own
and
heads.
Wouldn't have to pay actors to come in for the time to do it. And they were like, we'll just mold each other's heads and do it. And they had a great time. So I'm like, that's just a delight.
Yeah, this seemed like a very fun shoot for a script that was written in something like 8 days. I'm amazed at how much joy kind of comes out of this as a horror film. Like, it's a joyful horror film about creeps, which is great.
Yeah. And I also think it's, like, kind of fascinating. Like, everybody seems to love the experience. And Fred Decker was incredibly young when he made it, which is also kind of fascinating because it's a logistical nightmare. I mean, we talk about Toby Hooper and his crazy one. Like, this is as much effect almost. But also, it's kind of fascinating that, like, some people went on... like the two leads are in an early Roland Emmerich film called Ghost Chase together again. They are once again paired. So as much as this film, we can talk maybe a bit about, it had a very botched marketing and release and is a very cult movie. It was missing from, like, it wasn't a part of the horror canon until kind of the 2000s because people
their label Scream Factory are really instrumental in making this more accessible and making sure the director's cut exists and is kind of the preferred version.
But it's like, it's interesting that I think it leaked out to the industry that people liked this and these people were good. And like, so even though the film didn't make a huge impact, it made enough of an impact in the industry. Yeah.
This also has an alternate ending, which is sad, where there's a dog in this that is infected. And at the end, the dog comes up to Cynthia and infects her. And that's how the movie ends. So it's like it's starting all over again.
Which she's a great final girl. So I hate that that ending theatrically was undone because she's a really, really strong final girl.
I mean, I feel like the implication of the other ending is that the things are just going to get into the graveyard and make another zombie invasion.
But they don't infect
too,
her. Like, you don't, I mean, there's still potential they'd be okay. So that is one of the things where it's like, all right, there's more coming. Here's the sequel.
I guess if you love pets like I do, there's both a cat and a dog in this film. Two scenes with special effects. Very disturbing. Very upsetting.
I mean, the dog's still out there infecting people. Brad gets caught.
There are so many stories out there of actors who are, like, not necessarily prominent actors. Some are, but some aren't. Who just got careers because they just happened to be friendly with a famous actor. So Steve Marshall was PAing on a movie and became really good buddies with Robert Downey Jr. In Yugoslavia. And he's like, I think I'm just going to, you know, come hang out in L.A. He's like, yeah, come live with me. We'll get you some acting work. You'll be able to pay your bills. And I'm just like, because that's how it works. You just make friends with Robert Downey Jr.
He's Canadian, right? I could be wrong, but his dad was a very famous Canadian film producer working in Yugoslavia in the 80s.
Yes, he is Canadian. I believe he's actually returned to Canada as
cool.
well.
Huh.
It's also, like, on top of all the... We talked about Tales from the Crypt. Obviously, it is also incredibly EC Comics influenced. I feel like that Aliens plus Zombies is a real classic EC Comics. Or I also, if you like gross horror comics, I highly recommend Italian horror comics. They get a little, obviously, stomach-turningly erotic.
Like many Italian things.
But yes, fumetti, as they're called, they're odd. I think that you really see the influence of Tales from the Crypt. It's growing. Obviously, we have Creepshow at the same time kind of going around with Stephen King. So you're slowly seeing that influence infect more and more stuff.
With Tom Atkins in it.
Yeah.
But it's a pretty obvious trend that, like, people who grow up seeing one thing, then they start making their own versions of it later, and then you see it again. So, like, these trends do show up another, like, say, 10, 15 years down the line of people who grew up watching that thing want to make their own version of it.
And I think you're seeing, for instance, if you're talking about making your own version of it, the film Slither, which is just Night of the Creeps by James Gunn, is like Cronenberg plus of the Creeps. It's very much inspired by that. It has the same little slug dudes. It has some very similar instances, but also is a twist on it. And I think that you see these 80s movies coming back in the kind of 2000s, 2010s.
One, I think we're definitely recommending both these movies in a way. Invaders from Mars will be a specific audience, but Night of the Creeps is just super fun. Like, that one's like, yeah.
May I say, too, I think I've established I'm not a huge horror fan. I am forced to watch many horror films for my job, and I'm getting there. But I think if you have someone in your life who's maybe, like, can't handle a lot of horror, this is a very good gateway drug.
Yeah.
I think even as a kid, this would have been – it's just so loving and so campy that even when there's real scares – you're along for the ride. I really, really think this is a good one to introduce to people who might claim they don't like horror.
Agreed, agreed. And it sits on the sci-fi end of it, which more people find palatable. Once again, Alicia Fletcher, thank you so much.
Thank you, Becky. I also want to shout out Tom Atkins's line in Night of the Creeps where he says, there's good news and bad news. The good news is your dates are here. The bad news, they're dead. No one could deliver that line like that good, except for him.
Cameron Maitland, thank you so much.
Thanks. I will also shout out what I know to be Alicia's favorite Monster Kid movie from 1986, Critters,
so
which is a lot like it suits this. We could say that there's whole, you know, Spookies, Troll, Critters area, but it's not really worth talking about. But
yeah,
you know,
Critters.
I've never actually seen Critters. I have to add Critters to my list. Okay.
Listen, Critters 2.
Yeah,
Critters 2 is the better. Ghoulies 2 also the better. But, you know, give them a whirl.
All right. And you can join us again next week where we look at a movie about a bunch of burnouts in a parking lot that is eerily similar to my growing up in Alberta. We also have a very special guest, comedian podcaster Graham Clark is joining us. That's coming up next week. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the A Year in Film podcast from Hollywood Suite. If you enjoyed the show, please remember to rate and review us on your podcast platform. Want to email the podcast? You can do so at podcast@hollywoodsuite.ca. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, @HollywoodSuite. Hollywood Suite is the home of the movies that shaped the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. Always uncut and always commercial-free, Hollywood Suite lets you experience movies the way they were meant to be seen on 4 HD channels and Hollywood Suite on demand. Subscribe today at hollywoodsuite.ca. The A Year in Film podcast is hosted by Becky Shrimpton and produced by Becky Shrimpton, Alicia Fletcher, and Cameron Maitland, and featured Cameron Maitland and Alicia Fletcher as guests. Supervising producer is Ryan Mains. Executive producers are David Kynes and Julie Kumaria. Creative consultant is Emily Gagne. Audio engineering by Andy Reid. We'll see you next week.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.